Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, is there a suicide epidemic among gay youth? A rash of suicides in October of 2010, plus the recent death of a Visalia teen who took his life after telling other gay teens it gets better, is prompting action. We talk to experts and have advice for all parents. Plus, the battle over Jesse Morrow Mountain. Will it become a gravel pit? And art for the heart. But first, the tragic story of 19-year-old Eric James Borges of Visalia. On January 11th, Borges took his own life. His friends thought his life was getting better after what James described as a years of bullying and rejection. Borges had made a Life Gets Better video telling other gay youth to hang in there. It will get better. He was also a volunteer with the Trevor Project, a national organization providing crisis intervention and suicide prevention services to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth. Apparently, his pain was too deep. 1 month after making the video, Borges committed suicide.
My name is Eric James Borges, and I'm 19. A little over a year ago, I came out as a gay man. Whether you are in middle school, high school, or college, and are an LGBTQ youth, I know how you feel. I was raised in an extremist Christian household. My earliest recollections of my experience with relentless and ongoing bullying was in kindergarten, but of course to a lesser degree. The other students always knew I was different and seemed to sense that I didn't like girls. Throughout elementary, junior high, and high school, it got progressively worse. I was physically, mentally, emotionally, and verbally assaulted on a day-to-day basis for my perceived sexual orientation. I could not talk or go anywhere without someone saying or doing something.
Now, Borges' death came after a rash of suicides among gay youth, at least 13 during a one-month period in 2010, including 13-year-old Seth Walsh of Tehachapi. Here to discuss this important topic is William Van Landingham, regional coordinator of the Trevor Project and LGBTQ representative for Tulare and Kings County Suicide Prevention Task Force, and Noel Whitaker, Tulare Kings Suicide Prevention Task Force coordinator. And a little later, Peggy Moss, a bullying expert, will join us with information for all parents. Thank you for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
You know, one thing I have to say just personally for myself after reading these stories, it was so sad to read about these young people and just the way they suffered and the way they were treated. Now, Mr. Landingham, you knew Eric. You know, tell us a little bit about him as a person.
When I first met him, he was very shy and quiet. And over the year, 2 years that I did know him, he kind of blossomed and become the person that he was, a very inspiring young man, dedicated to everyone and making sure that things did get better.
You know, I read a lot about him just before this program. And the thing was, he was thinking about others even up to the point when he took his own life. Like I read that. He wanted to pay you back for a phone bill. He wrote a check for you. And he also donated $500 to the Born This Way Foundation, Lady Gaga's foundation. He really admired her. What does she mean to him? And why was that special for him?
Well, not only did he enjoy the music and what she stood for and also her foundation, but it was the inspiration that he picked up from it. And also seeing that she was trying to get things better for everybody by doing outreach and being an advocate for those that possibly would be bullied, teased, and just perceived different.
Well, I would also like to get your thoughts on why, and I know you do have a concern about the way the media covers this, so
right.
you know, please interject and make it politically correct for us.
Okay.
Your thoughts on why we are seeing so many suicides among this group of teens?
They've kind of always been there because of the treatment that they've received, the bullying, the teasing, family rejection. There's a lot of parameters there that come across. And it was just now, though, with the media being able to be immediate, whereas before it would take a couple of weeks beforehand that it would be in the news. And also another thing is knowing that it's going to be better if they came out. And that's what happens there is before they hid themselves in a possibility of doing completing a suicide, but it was not recorded as an LGBT or that it was a suicide. It was just accidental or any of things along that line, because not all were reported as suicide. Mm-hmm. But now they're coming out a lot younger and trying to become their own self and live their orientation. And by doing that, we hear more about it and know who they are and how they're trying to become their own selves. And in doing that, they're still getting the bullying and everything else that is surrounded by that type of perception of the people.
Well, you know, many of these young people talked about being repeatedly bullied at school. And, you know, I'm wondering, why was this allowed to go on? I thought many schools have anti-bullying curriculum at this point. And not only that, it happens among, you know, teenagers. Because I have a teenager, and I wonder, you know, sometimes they just don't seem to understand as far as what they're saying and how that impacts other people.
Right. What happens there is most schools do have anti-bullying policies in place, but it's the actual enactment of it to be able to keep it enforced. And the thing is, they're not only receiving it at school and on campus, but also at home and in the community. And what the Trevor Project and the Suicide Prevention Task Force is trying to do is outreach to these people, not just to the ones that are in the crisis or thinking of suicide, but the adults, the caregivers, the other students that are there, and teaching them about the power of words, power of what their actions could cause.
Now, Mr. Whitaker, I know that you work with training. Do you train with the schools? I know you work with the Trevor Project, but do you also do outreach in the schools and the community as well?
Sure. Through our suicide prevention efforts, we actually have about 30 trainers that volunteer their time to go out and train anybody in the community that's willing to come and participate in the training. Through our website, sptf.org, we actually list all of the training that's available. We provide it completely for free. And we do have a lot of participation through the schools and then also through the Trevor Project with their lifeguard workshops. They're actively seeking to come to more schools and spread the word about suicide prevention and awareness.
First of all, because we've been talking about the Trevor Project, tell us what the Trevor Project is.
Trevor Project is a nonprofit organization dealing with crisis and suicide prevention with the LGBT youth, ages 13 to 24. They're the national leading lifeline for that population. And it all started back in 1994 with receiving an Academy Award for the movie called Trevor. And since then, the inception of showing it on HBO, what phone number could they flash up after the movie? They didn't have one in the United States at all for the LGBT youth. They created it. And since then, they've come out with a lot more programs, and in particular, the lifeguard workshops that go into schools and actually teach about suicide prevention and how people could get involved.
Have the schools been receptive to the Trevor Project?
Very much so. I think we've all been surprised by the reception that the schools have given, not just to the Trevor Project, but to our suicide prevention efforts in general, both in Tulare County and in Kings County.
Okay. What is it that makes the teen years so critical for gay youth?
I think the main thing there is that age range of 13 to 24. Most of us have kind of forgotten about the coping mechanisms that we have. They haven't developed them yet. They're still getting those skills, built into themselves and into their everyday life. And so things seem to be more devastating. And also because they're trying to not only develop those skills, but skills for being able to stay in school, skills to be able to figure out what they're going to do in life. But then you add this on top of it, and it just kind of – it really gets detrimental to them.
Now, you both work with young people. You counsel them. You know, what are they telling you? What are they're struggling? What are they struggling with?
A lot of the ones that I deal with, in particular, are ones with that have just like Eric James, the family rejection, and they're trying to be accepted because they never thought that they would lose that aspect of it, and that is one of the things too that if on family rejection, it's a possibility of 8 times more attempts at suicide than in the heterosexual peers because their family rejection is different. That normally that's the rejection is because of possibly pregnancies or doing something else, whereas in the LGBT, it's their orientation that they're looking at, the real person.
You know, despite this is not new. You know, I'm not saying the suicides are not new, but the whole issue of gay young people and gay people in our society, why is it just still such this – we still see these young people and other gay people being targeted in such a way?
What I look at it as is a lot of times what happens is the person that's doing the bullying or teasing or is trying to put the direction or the attention onto another person because they feel that they're not quite up to what they should be either. And so instead of waiting for themselves to be bullied or teased, they put it out onto somebody else. So it's like an easiest target is when someone perceives to be gay. And not always everyone that they're teasing or bullying is, but those that's the numbers that are showing up.
I think we also have a large crossover with teens in general right now, the sort of proliferation of social networks and social media. People are living their lives to a much greater extent in the social realm. So news spreads, bullying spreads much easier through those networks. But we aren't actually seeing an epidemic in youth suicides. It's sort of staying pretty par for the course as it has for a long time. It's just the greater level of coverage that the media has been giving to the issue of the youth suicides, which is sort of a mixed blessing. It's helping to get more resources and information out, but at the same time, there's an effect called suicide contagion, which is more information is released if people that are vulnerable start feeling more sort of akin to the folks that the news media is reporting on, then that can actually elevate their own risk and lead to suicide attempts.
And you talk about the way – what are some of the ways in which the media covers this that can sometimes make the situation worse?
Well, I think if there's a lot of aggrandizement about the suicide death in particular or a lot of personal information that's shared or they glorify it, say with a death like Marilyn Monroe's death, the more that the story provides opportunities for somebody to see similarities between the person who died by suicide and themselves – and if they're in a vulnerable state, then that leads to a greater chance that they might attempt suicide or see suicide as a reasonable decision to make. Frequently, people who are making that decision to attempt or commit suicide are in a place of just immense hurting and immense pain, and they see this as one of the best choices that they can make, which is unfortunate. And when you couple that with teens and their uneven brain development, it takes a lot longer for the frontal lobe to develop than other parts of the brain. And the frontal lobe is associated with the sort of long-term risk and reward decisions. So teens who are under a great deal of stress, they're being bullied, they feel excluded from their family and their support networks, and they have that brain development lack, it creates a really bad situation for them.
And I also see here one of the no's is, which I've already broken the rule, is describing recent suicides as an epidemic or skyrocketing or other strong terms.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of a thing of it is, and it puts it out there. And it just like he was saying, the undeveloped mind or coping that the youth have is they see that and they start thinking about it. Well, yeah, it is an epidemic. Yes, I should contribute to it. or they kind of see that fame that's happened because it's out there on the front page.
And what you advise is really to take it in a way where you're giving out information more instead of, you know, talking about the incident itself, but use it as an opportunity to try to give out information.
Right. And on that, too, is like in what I got from Eric James and also for what he wrote in his video is, yes, the program works. There are people out there that care. There are people, so keep going at it, and I want to reach out to as many people as I can.
So one of the important things along those lines is to make sure that the audience itself is aware of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which can be reached at 800-273-8255, as well as the Trevor line, which can be reached at
1-866 for you, Trevor.
Now, I know, and I don't want to minimize the fact that, you know, suicide among all young people is a concern, and bullying among all young people is a concern. But for gay youth, you know, what should parents and friends kind of be looking for?
Not actually looking for.
Or be aware of.
Yeah, more aware of is the family acceptance. And that's one of the programs that the Suicide Prevention Task Force is also working on, plus with PFLAG, which is an organization, parents, family, and friends of lesbians and gays. And Dr. Hall in Visalia has arranged for someone to come down from San Francisco University into Tulare in Kings County. And it's called Family Acceptance, and it's giving them how they can support their child. What not to say, what to say. It kind of gives you a little bit of verbiage, but also a proper language into being able to give that support. And if you're not quite sure what to say or do, then go find some support for yourself also. And PFLAG, Trevor Project, and the Suicide Task Force is really a good place to go for those resources.
So what I'm hearing here is these young people, they may be bullied at school or with their friends, but the family acceptance is really important, and the family support is really important.
Right, because what do you do when you're growing up? You know, you're born, you're a baby, you're supported through that era, and then you start to grow up and you're starting to try to become your own person. And that's where you get also that support from your family. And if that's taken away and you get no support in the community, you get no support at school, you get no support at home, where do you go? And that's the ultimate question is who's going to help you? And it's like people like Noah and myself that are around that have such a passion for this that we try to find people to be able to help and support.
Okay, at this point, I would like to bring in Peggy Moss. She is the author of Say Something. She's also a consultant to schools to prevent bullying. Thanks for joining us, Peggy.
My pleasure. It's great to be here in such good company.
Thank
you. Love what you do at the Trevor Project.
Thank you.
And I'm glad to hear PFLAG getting mentioned.
And also at this time, I'd also like to invite our listeners to call in because we're going to be talking about, you know, what parents can do. And if you have any questions about bullying and how to approach your child about bullying or to find out if it is because they don't often talk about it. So you can give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989 or online at kvpr.org. And with you, Mrs. Moss, you were saying bullying is a problem among all young people, not just gay youth. And suicide within those teen years is really difficult.
Yep, it is. And I have to agree with your other guests that it's a double-edged sword to have a focus on suicide in the same way that that there's been a focus on school violence. In both instances, it's raised really important issues and gotten us to focus on bullying. On the other hand, there are a lot of issues with bullying and teasing and parental support that happily don't get to that excruciatingly painful headline-making level. And there's a lot that the parents can do for their kids who are getting bullied and teased, and just by sort of being aware of the possibility that your child is being teased or struggling at school, and knowing that when your child is being teased or bullied, they might be, and in fact are likely to be, really ashamed that it's happening. And like us, when we as adults are stressed out, they're unlikely to come home and say, I'm feeling stressed or I've been teased, in the same way that when we come home from work, we don't say, I'm feeling stressful. We probably say something nasty to our partners or our children, because that's how we deal with stress. And so for parents, it becomes really important to model how we deal with stressful situations, how we deal with an imbalance of power, how we deal with difference, because that's what kids see. And we can say, until we're blue in the face, that we think it's absolutely okay for kids to be who they are, and we embrace that. But if we only ask our daughters whether they're dating boys and never ask, you know, a gender-neutral question, and if we allow people in our house to make hurtful and derogatory comments about people who are different from ourselves, then we're reinforcing inadvertently for our kids a really painful environment.
We have Shirley from Oakhurst. Hello, Shirley.
Yes.
Hi. You had a... go ahead.
I just have a very big concern about my son. He's 14 and been going through a divorce that's been finalized. That's been torturous to my kids because my ex can't drop his anger and just get along, so to speak. And so all throughout this divorce, my son is kind of used the threat of suicide, and he's been in counseling, et cetera. But I'm looking at the high school years and just, well, for the last 2 years, my ex has ostracized my son to a point that the last 2 years he didn't speak to me. And I've been working with counselors, and they just really, really were no help. And I finally talked to my son. I said, look, you want something, I want something, what do you want? And he finally came out and said, I want to spend more time with Dad. And I said, I got that. You're a boy. Excuse me. You're a boy. He's a man. I get it. And I said, what I want is a communication line open with you. But I guess my concern is how that's going to affect my son in the future. And is his depression and suicidal notions going to kick back in? And how to keep that family tie strong without tearing down my son?
Well, I think it's really just, you know, I can't say because I'm not a psychologist or anything, but I would say the communication is always key.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's very important, is the communication and keeping that line on. And in particular with the divorce, because then the child is very torn apart a little bit because they want to be with Dad but also want to be with Mom. And, you know, it's that thing. You've got to keep talking and making sure that no matter what the problem is, that it feels safe to come and say it to you and let you know what the feelings are going on.
Another thing that you can do for yourself as well, in Visalia specifically, we offer training called Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training, and we offer it at least once a month. It's completely free. It's a two-day training, and it really goes over the signs and symptoms of suicide risk, how to interact with somebody who might be suicidal. So it'll at least could aid you in getting in better touch with your son and some of the things that he's going through. So you can find information about that on our website, sptf.org, or you can call my number, 559-623-2144.
Great.
And we'll give out those numbers again at the end. Shirley, thanks a lot for calling us. We appreciate
it. All right. Good luck to
you guys. And also I wanted to bring back in Peggy, because you were mentioning something that's really, really important, and that oftentimes – the young people aren't going to come home and say, oh, gee, I'm being bullied. So how is it that you can have that conversation with them or try to identify what is going on with them?
Luckily, there are a bunch of different strategies. And actually, I should mention that one of them is empoweringparents.com online. Talks to parents about how to do this, and PrevNet. kids.ca talks a lot about talking to kids about bullying. But the points I would raise is one, it might not be you. You might not be the trusted adult that your child wants to talk to at a particular time, and that's okay. Make sure that your child knows someone else that they can talk to and let that conversation happen. And it might not be a direct conversation. Often a child will be able to talk to you about the experience that a character is having in a book more easily than they can talk to you about an experience that they are having themselves. And there are a lot of tools out there for using literature to reach into kids and talk. It may be that talking about Hermione Granger in Harry Potter comes very easily to your child, and you can talk about how she copes and who she leans on and how she gets through situations, and praise the courage that it takes to intervene and the courage it takes to walk away. And your child will get that message without you having to have that direct conversation.
And one other thing I would like to add to this, too, is that in a lot of these cases, these young people talked about being bullied at school, going to talk to school officials, and how it didn't do any good. So how do you approach the school?
I in the past, would never do a bullying workshop at a school without first training teachers. Because when we ask kids to intervene, and it's really important for them to intervene, they do need backup. It's the hardest thing in the world to do, as all of us know from sitting at our Thanksgiving dinner table and trying to intervene when someone's inappropriate. It's really hard what we ask kids to do, to intervene out on the playground or in the hallway, and they need the backup of teachers. And my comment to teachers, one of the things that teachers raise a lot, two things. One, the best teachers tend actually never to hear it, and that took me a long time to believe. But kids know which teachers are walking safe zones, and if they are near those teachers, the hateful, derogatory teasing doesn't happen because those teachers would never tolerate it. But if a teacher or an adult, and this goes for us as parents when we're in the car and hear comments, if we don't do anything, it reinforces for the kid that what was said to them was okay. And they absorb the blow of that comment in an entirely different way. So as adults around kids, we really have to, at least, at the very least, make a comment. I heard that. That's not appropriate. That's not okay. That's not funny. Something that resonates with the child who's being targeted so that they know we don't think it's okay for them to be called something hurtful and derogatory. Okay. It doesn't have to be a long lecture, but it has to be something.
Okay. Well, and this topic we could talk some more, but we're getting close to out of time. So what I would like to do is try to wrap up with where can people go, starting here locally, and the organizations that they can turn to?
One of the biggest ones here locally is the PFLAG, which is for parents, family, and friends of lesbians and gays. They have one here in Fresno. They have one in Tulare Kings County, and they have one in Bakersfield. And I think they also have in Modesto, which would be close to the coverage area from Merced. So those are real good resources because they advocate, educate, and support LGBT youth and their parents. Another one is our websites or telephone numbers for the Trevor Project, where they're able to go in there. And a parent can call. It doesn't have to be the youth that calls that's in crisis. The parents questioning, and they need some answers. Also, the National Lifeline, that's a good spot too. Then we also have right here in Fresno the MyLGBT+, which is a resource for the youth. And my understanding, most of these websites will be going onto your website at the end when I talk to someone. And then we have, like in Tulare County, for the Tulare Youth Service Bureau, there's a drop-in group for the LGBT on Thursdays. And I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I think it's like from 3 to 5. And then also in Kings County in Hanford, there's also a LGBT support group.
And Noah?
Yeah, another great organization is NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. They can help specifically with folks struggling with depression or how to interact with their friends, family members, or loved ones that might have a mental illness. Also, my correct phone number is 559-624-7471. And if you call me directly, I can help provide linkage and information to these different resources as well.
Okay. Well, thank you all. William Van Landingham, Regional Coordinator with the Trevor Project, Noah Whitaker, Tulare Kings County Suicide Prevention Task Force Coordinator, and Peggy Maugh, an expert on bullying. Thank you all for joining us this morning. We truly appreciate it. I'm Renita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Renita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Every spring, the landscape of eastern Fresno County comes alive with millions of fruit trees in bloom. But this year, the Blossom Trail is also ground zero in a battle for the future of the region, one that pits the needs of the construction industry against area residents, Native Americans, and the county's emerging tourism industry. FM 89's Joe Moore has this report.
Take a drive east on Highway 180 from Fresno towards Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, and you'll see a landscape as varied as the valley itself. Neatly arranged orchards give way to the lush green basin of the Kings River and the rustic towns of Centerville and Minkler. And just as the highway begins its climb into the Sierra foothills, off to the left, the first hill you see is Jesse Morrow Mountain.
It's a very beautiful mountain. It's about 2,800 feet. It's got oak trees on it. It certainly has a lot of wildlife on it. It's the first view of the Sierra Nevada Range as you're traveling east towards the national parks.
That's Jim Van Hahn, owner of the Cedar View Winery and Sequoia View Bed and Breakfast.
So this is the 2009 Zinfandel.
They're among a handful of businesses along the highway, catering to the tourists who come to see the national parks and the Blossom Trail. But that scenic view may soon undergo a dramatic change. On Thursday, the Fresno County Planning Commission will vote on a proposal to allow CEMEX, a construction materials company based in Mexico, to dig an open-pit hard rock mine on an 800-acre site on the south side of the mountain.
They're still actually contemplating on dynamiting that mountain out. And the view for us would be a view of a sand and gravel plant, an asphalt batch plant, and just all the ancillary facilities.
If approved, the mine would produce around 1.5 million tons a year of broken rock called aggregate, which is used in the concrete and asphalt that goes into local construction projects.
That is critical to the construction of roads and highways, and bridges, dams, high-speed rail.
That's Michael Prandini, president of the Building Industry Association of Fresno and Madera Counties. He says that when the economy improves, the area will have a shortage of construction materials, much like it did before the recession.
At one time, when in 2005, I believe, they were having to import aggregate because the construction was booming so much.
CEMEX representative Jolene Polyak says the mine will have a big economic impact.
Well, we had an economist in the Bay Area look at the numbers. She said that it'll contribute $36 million a year to the local economy. Nearly $7 million will come directly from labor income.
Polyak says this new mine is essential, as the company's existing mines near Fryant and Lemon Cove are nearly depleted. And unlike other mines in river bottom areas, this site on Jesse Morrow Mountain wouldn't wipe out farms.
The beauty of Jesse Morrow Mountain is that it's not prime ag land. So this is land that currently isn't bringing anything into the county coffers, but will then become an economic benefit to the county.
CEMEX also claims the new project would reduce CO2 emissions that contribute to global warming, thanks to shorter trips from the mine to local construction sites.
if you've got the aggregate close to where the growth is, which we project the growth being Clovis, Reedley, and Sanger, then that's less truck miles, which obviously reduces the greenhouse gas. So, for example, Kalinga, a round trip to Kalinga to the Fresno area is 120 miles, whereas for Jesse Morrow, it would be 40.
But those arguments haven't been enough to win over many area residents who remain bitterly opposed to the project, which has been in the works for around a decade.
I knew that it would be going through some sort of environmental review, and so I just started galvanizing the community. And a lot of folks in the community had no idea of what was going on and the impacts to it. So we formed Friends of Jesse Morrow Mountain some 6 to 8 years ago.
The group has rallied around the cause of preserving the mountain, attacking the project on fronts ranging from air and water quality to its effect on the local tourism industry.
We get people from all over the world, literally, that come up to Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks because they are World Heritage Sites. And it just reflects on us badly because the first thing they see of the Sierra Nevada range is Jesse Morrow Mountain. And right now it's a pristine place. It's a very beautiful mountain. And with the CMEX proposed project, they'll see something entirely different.
Just down the road from the winery is the Schoolhouse Restaurant and Tavern. The business just opened a little over a week ago in an old red brick schoolhouse dating from the 1920s.
Hello! Welcome to the schoolhouse.
Inside are two of the owners of the Art Stand, a co-op art gallery that sits directly across Highway 180 at the base of the mountain.
And I'm Deanna Bristow, and I have lived in this area all my life, so I feel very possessive about it, and I don't want to see that silhouette change whatsoever.
Elaine Town Lane shares a similar view.
An open pit mine, yeah. That's not inducive to tourism whatsoever. It's ugly.
But while aesthetics may be the top concern for area business owners, it's the potential cultural impacts of the mine that have generated some of the project's most vocal critics.
We know it as Ohalish, Crying Mountain. There's a significant history about that mountain for our people.
Audrey Osborne is the tribal historian for the traditional Choinumni tribe east of the Kings River. Her people have lived in the area for well over 6,000 years. She says the mountain is one of several sacred sites to the Choinumni people.
There was fasting ceremonies done on that mountain. You know, there was coming-of-age ceremonies. There's a lot of history there. But, you know, you got to remember, too, that, you know, death came in those times, or disease. And, you know, we couldn't always take our people up. There, you know, there's people that had to be buried where they were. So, you know, all of that history, all of that is there. And if you are a Choinumni and you know your significant history, you'd know what the impact of that mountain will have on us.
But not all of the Choinumni people feel the same way. A separate branch of the tribe, the Kings River Choinumni Farm Tribal Council, disagrees. They say the mountain isn't significant, and they support the CMEX project. The company has agreed to lease the Tribal Council 40 acres of land at the site, which it will donate to the tribe if the project is ultimately approved. The Tribal Council would also receive around $40,000 from the company. The Kings River Farm Tribal Council did not respond to our requests for an interview. The dispute over the mountain has even caught the attention of the California Native American Heritage Commission in Sacramento.
You know, our agency's been concerned with the project down there.
Dave Singleton is a program analyst with the commission.
We feel there's enough justification that's been presented to us by the archaeology community as well as the Native American community to indicate that it's a sacred area.
So where does this leave the project? And what are some of the possible solutions? CMEX says it's listened to the public and has revised its original plan.
When it was initially proposed, it was a 100-year project, and it was going to be on the ridge of the mountain.
And this new alternative plan is the one that will go before the Planning Commission this Thursday.
And basically what that means is it's bringing it down off the ridge. It's closer to the mine itself, so it'll be more difficult to see from Highway 180. And then we cut the duration from 100 years to 50 years.
Still, despite the changes, the Friends of Jesse Morrow Mountain remain opposed. But Jim Van Hahn says this isn't a typical case of not-in-my-backyard opposition.
And all of us in the community are for sand and gravel mining. It's just an area of location.
He says alternate sites for aggregate mining exist nearby, including the Carmelita Project, a proposed 1,500-acre mine owned by Garawan Farms on Reed Avenue, just a few miles away. The land, which is currently home to fruit trees, would be mined in a conventional manner, similar to the existing sand and gravel mines on the Kings and San Joaquin Rivers. But even after all the controversy, years of analysis and debate, not to mention the recent death of her mother, tribal elder Angie Osborne, Audrey remains committed to the fight to preserve what her people know as Wahalish.
We are obligated by honor to protect our site and our history, not only for us, but for generations to come.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
You can also see photos of Jesse Morrow Mountain, the proposed mine, and read the project's environmental impact report on our website at kbpr.org. Now, joining me now to further discuss this issue is Dr. Jean Otto, dentist and president of Friends of Jesse Morrow Mountain, and Donna Hacker, also a member of Friends of Jesse Morrow Mountain. Both of you, this is getting ready to go to, before the Fresno County Planning Commission. It has been talked about for years. Do you feel like you have a chance as far as stopping this entire project?
Well, we certainly wouldn't be going forward with what we're doing if we didn't feel that way. It seems like on any one of these points, the significant and avoidable points that the county is on their FEIR should be enough to stop this project because it's affecting air quality, traffic. I mean, it's everything.
Are there any alternatives being proposed other than mining Jesse Morrow Mountain?
Yes, and that's a fact that has come up somewhat recently. They have approved for a project in Selma on the corner of Conejo and Peach, which is a railroad distribution center. And that distribution center could supply all of the aggregate needed, as well as having the concrete batch plant and a batch plant for the road surface for the blacktop. Essentially, the rail project there can, at the point when they get it built out in 90 days, they will be able to handle 100 railroad cars, each carrying 100 tons each. And so you're talking a lot of aggregate there. Works out to over 3 million tons a year. And rather than blowing up Jesse Morrow Mountain, if they feel that they really need more gravel, and they shouldn't be looking at doing more mines, they should be looking at expanding the rail distribution center. And that's not going to require any mining.
But we talked about the alternative that you think is an alternative to mining. But the CMIX, haven't they proposed a alternative that they think is better?
Yeah, they have proposed their alternative four, which they call a Ridgeline Preservation Act. Or project. And the county has kind of been leaning toward that as being less of a problem for the areas that they're concerned in. The problem with that is it creates some of its own problems. It does preserve the ridge line, which was going to be mined, but they're starting down just below the ridge line at 1,000-foot level, and now they're going down 200 feet below ground surface level at the base of the mountain. That's actually below the level of Highway 180, and they're going to going to create an open pit. So this is going from being a bench mine to actually being a bench mine and an open pit mine. They're going to leave an open pit 200 feet deep, and we don't know how big around at the base of that mountain. And that has brought up some other concerns that the county has even mentioned, and that is that they may actually run into the groundwater going that deep, or the heavy equipment operating down in there that gives off diesel fuel and oil and all those kind of pollutants. That pollutant is going to get down into the groundwater there.
And this is also a project, I think another alternative they put in, instead of mining for 100 years, which is kind of unimaginable, they will shut down after 50 years.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's something too. You know, they've said, well, this has really reduced this project. We're going to cut it clear down to 50 years. That's like cutting it in half. But you know, when you have a mine that's been there 50 years, it's a lot easier to get it expanded and keep right on going. They'll keep mining until there's no aggregate left. And the other thing is they're talking about reducing the amount per year. Well, they're going from 2 million tons a year down to 1.5 million tons a year. That's still taking an awful lot of aggregate out of that mountain.
Why Jesse Morrow Mountain as far as the choice?
Well,
because it's my understanding that I've read that there are other sites that have already been approved for mining and for aggregate and that source.
Well, there are quite a few mines that are along the Kings River, and that has been designated as a mining zone. And there's been a lot of fighting because of the pollution and problems you have along the river. And that's one of CEMEX's claims, is that here at least you're not mining along the river. But, you know, you're going to blow up the mountain right in front of your face, and that creates other problems. When you start blasting, you know, because they're going to be blasting along the benches, and they're going to be blasting that air into our air, and it's when you start out at a 1,000-foot level and you blast from there, that puts it right up into the circulation pattern that goes right over Clovis and Fresno.
Do you think that they have a case as far as preserving this? Let's say if the Planning Commission moves forward, would they have a legal case?
Well, if the Planning Commission approves this, then basically we are going to appeal it to the Board of Supervisors. If it goes to the Board of Supervisors, then the next step after that, if it was approved, would be to go into court and actually file a lawsuit against it. And we think there's enough reasons not to do it that we would be amazed if the Board of Supervisors actually approved this, because there's so many big negative effects. They do have a way of kind of pushing these negative effects to the side, in that they can go for a statement of overriding consideration, which means that they feel that there's enough reason to do it that they still would go ahead even though there's significant and unavoidable impacts that are quite substantial.
No, I hope I'm not wrong in this, but I did read that many of the supervisors have received campaign contributions from CEMEX.
Is that true? Yeah, there is on record that there have been campaign contributions. We also see that CEMEX has been going around and actually donating money to local things. I have a paper right here that CEMEX just donated $10,000 to Sanger Schools. So, you know, they've been spreading some money around for sure.
Well, the vote or the hearing before the Planning Commission, it is
Thursday morning, and we would like to have as many people there as we can to show opposition to it. It's going to be they open at 8:45, but I would say get there early.
Okay. Well, we thank you both for coming in, and I'm sure this is not the last on Jesse Morrow Mountain.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Anita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. A very unique and fun art exhibit is on display in Visalia. It is Arts of Visalia's 17th Sofa Art Show. And here to tell us more about it is Kevin Bowman, gallery director and curator with Arts Visalia.
Hi.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, an exhibit designed around sofas. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, as you said, it started, this is the 17th year. It started in 1996, I believe. And it was a kind of a tongue-in-cheek play on the idea of art being made to match one's sofa. And it started out of a class that Varian Mace, who was then an instructor at College of the Sequoias, offered to some of her students in some of her classes, and they created a show out of it, and it became kind of a popular event, and it's kind of grown a life of its own.
I bet. I bet it should be some interesting sofa art. Now, some of these, this is going to be sold to benefit pro-youth art, correct?
Correct.
Tell me about pro-youth art, HEART.
Well, pro-youth and the HEART program that they operate is also a nonprofit organization like ourselves, and they serve about 4,000 students ages, well, K through 12, at 27 different school sites here in Tulare County. With what they do is provide after-school programs in a variety of formats at the different school sites. And they've been around for, well, I'd say about 15, 20 years, if I remember correctly. So they're a youth-oriented, after-school-oriented program. And they came to us with this idea of, can we partner with you for this year so far and invite some artists to make artworks that we could offer at silent auction to raise some funds for the HEART program and build some additional awareness of the programs in the community. And we thought it was a great idea and gave us an opportunity to do something with the sofa art show that was maybe a little beyond what we would normally do as an art center, as an art gallery. It's nice to be able to partner with other organizations and use the art as a vehicle for other purposes, other good purposes.
And in a way, you know, partnering with the youth, this is sort of, you know, right up what Arts Visalia does, because you're trying to promote art within the entire community and also reaching out to young people to start early as far as getting them to appreciate and explore and to love art.
Absolutely. That's a big part of our efforts. We have a pretty active education program for kids and for adults. And we serve a lot of kids ourselves, certainly not to the sort of numbers that Pro Youth does, but we're really committed to that. I think it's hugely important, especially given the constrictions that the school systems face now with providing arts in the schools. I think that nonprofits can play a role in helping serve that need in the community.
Well, we talked a little bit about the history of how this whole sofa art show came into being. Tell us a little bit about some of the artwork itself using sofas. What will we see?
Well, you'll see quite a variety. And that's no exaggeration to say that the show features it really has a tongue-in-cheek quality, and it's filled with puns, visual puns, both on the idea of the sofa, which is always the central character, it seems, in the artworks, and then the secondary theme of the heart, and that is left open to interpretation for the artists. But you'll see paintings, you'll see collages, photographs, you'll see sculptures. There's a sculpture made by Dr. Alex Leachman. It's actually a working fountain, and there's a number of sculptural pieces like that that are really pretty creative. It's pretty stunning to see the variety of ideas people come up with to respond to the theme.
And you have some other interesting exhibits coming up right after this, don't you?
Oh, yeah. We have a new exhibition every month, and it's an intense schedule for us as an organization putting the shows together. But, yes, next month, for instance, we'll host an exhibition that's focused on regional artists. It's what's called the Alliance of California Artists Open Juried Competition, and it's another instance where we partner with another organization, in this case, the Alliance of California Artists, based in Clovis. We host an opportunity for artists in the region to come and to compete with their works in various categories. Following that, in April, we will host an exhibition of gourd art and basket weaving from artists from throughout the United States. In fact, a number from this area. And that's going to be tied in with a conference that will be held here in Visalia called Containers of Our Culture.
And now the SOFA art show, it will go on until how long? People will be able to come and see that?
It will close on Friday, February 24th.
Okay.
And our regular closing time, 5:30.
Okay, so that's the current exhibit, and it will be up until February 24th. And it's looks like a very interesting show, so we want to encourage people to go to Visalia and take a look. And we would like to thank you, Mr. Bowman, for joining us this morning.
Well, we certainly appreciate you recognizing our work, and so thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.